Would you like to accelerate your career and reach your full potential in just minutes a day? Welcome to the LeadX Show with New York Times bestselling author and Inc. 500 entrepreneur, Kevin Cruz.
Hey guys, Kevin Cruz here. Welcome to the LeadX Leadership Show, where we help you to stand out and to get ahead at work. Now, as you know, we like to switch things up here, keep it interesting, and to continue that tradition, today on the podcast, instead of me interviewing an expert guest, we're going to have the guest deep dive into their topic. You see, you'll be hearing audio from a LeadX webinar. Now, of course, there are dozens of great webinars on leadership, management, communication, productivity, and more, all archived in the LeadX app. Just visit leadx.org for more information about our webinar archive. So enough on the setup, enough background information. Here is Vanya Mathis to introduce our guest and to hand it over to them. Enjoy.
Welcome to Managing Remote Teams, 6 Best Practices for Success. Our guest host today is a Program Management Office Director at Cisco Systems, where he leads global virtual teams on delivering large and complex programs. And he has authored several Amazon best-selling books, including Influencing Virtual Teams and Don't Reply All. Today, he's going to show you how you can effectively manage your team members while they work from home. You're going to learn the number one reason why virtual teams fail, how you can communicate more effectively with your remote team, and tactics that will help you assign and delegate work in a remote environment. Please welcome Hassan Osman.
Welcome to Managing Remote Teams. My name is Hassan Osman, and today we're going to be talking about 6 best practices for success. So here's what I'm going to be covering today. I'll start that with a little bit of a bio or background about myself. We'll then cover some virtual team statistics, and then we'll talk about the number one reason why virtual teams fail. And then we'll cover 6 best practices that you can use and help in terms of helping you out managing your team. All right, so let me start with a quick speaker bio or background. So my name is Hassan Osman. I'm currently a PMO director at Cisco Systems. PMO stands for Program Management Office, and I lead a team of senior program managers who are all remote on delivering complex IT programs. I do have to mention that views are my own and not those of Cisco, so I don't represent Cisco's business in any way. I'm also the author of a few books about remote work, including Influencing Virtual Teams and Don't Reply All. And I've been fortunate that they're number one Amazon bestsellers. And I'm also an instructor on about courses regarding remote work, mainly delivered online. I'm part of the Udemy for Business instructor pool, which is a selection of courses delivered for Fortune 1000 companies. And I teach everything from how to manage your remote team to how to have better virtual meetings. The little Venn diagram I have shared here shows 3 circles that intersect: virtual teams, project management, and productivity. And I usually kind of show that when I want to give a little bit of information about my background and areas of interest. So with the project management circle, I've been in project management for most of my career, worked at EY, analyzing why projects fail. And today, of course, with Cisco Systems. Virtual teams, similarly, for the majority of my career, I've been working in virtual teams as an entrepreneur. And then in the corporate world, I've also done some research in the space and why virtual teams fail from an academic perspective. And then finally, the third circle is productivity. I'm a productivity geek. I drive my wife and little kids crazy around the house, always trying to kind of optimize everything. And I'm a big fan of David Allen's Getting Things Done book and process. Highly recommend it if you're interested in productivity there. And then the 3 circles intersect in the middle, and that's where I usually spend most of my time writing, publishing, webinars, speaking, and what have you. And I do run a blog called thecouchmanager.com, where I write frequently about remote work, and I'd be happy to connect with you via LinkedIn or any of the social media platforms. All right, so enough about me. Let's get into some virtual team statistics about virtual teams. So 1 in 5 workers worldwide telecommute. This is according to Reuters research. A little bit outdated, so it's probably a little bit higher today. But telecommuting is highly popular in India, with around 50% of the workforce telecommuting there, followed by countries such as Mexico, Indonesia, and the Philippines. 5 million employees work at home half the time or more in the U.S. That constitutes around 3.6% of the U.S. workforce. So a lot to catch up with other countries, but this is according to research from Global Workplace Analytics based on some of the 2018 data. Definitely much higher today with what happened with coronavirus. And then finally, another statistic is $44 billion in yearly productivity savings of U.S. employers in 2015. This is according to U.S. News and FlexJobs. And productivity is measured in terms of things like better work retention due to better work-life balance and higher employee productivity. And again, of course, all those statistics were pre the coronavirus pandemic. And lately, you know, a lot of news on CNN, Fortune, basically headlines saying that companies have ramped up on remote work due to COVID-19 to prevent spreading disease and basically using social distancing. And, you know, Politico wrote a fantastic article not too long ago about how coronavirus will change the world permanently. And there were 34 big thinkers in the world that sort of gave their thoughts about how they think the world is going to change. One was about the rise of telemedicine and how healthcare is going to change, not just for doctors helping patients remotely, but even patients who are at their house, instead of exposing others to their disease, they can get diagnosis and what have you while they're at home, right? And that sort of helps a lot with the social distancing aspect and a few other things. Another was that Congress can finally go virtual. According to Ethan Zuckerman from MIT, he speaks about the fact that with the social distancing, it's probably not a wise idea to have the House of Representatives in a single room, right? And a lot of government officials since this pandemic have shifted to working remotely as well. But perhaps the best or the most insightful comment comes from Deborah Tannen, who is a professor at Georgetown. And what she states is that she believes that personal interactions will be rethought and that we're going to be flipping that scenario. So today, a lot of us ask, is there a reason to do this online? But tomorrow, we'll be asking, is there any good reason to do this in person? Meaning we will probably default to online on everything and do things in person by exception. Now, of course, all this doesn't come without its challenges, right? The Atlantic reporting that the coronavirus is creating a huge stressful experiment in working from home. Time stating that the coronavirus is making us see that it's hard to make remote work actually work, right? So a lot of those companies that haven't been in the remote work space are finding some challenges. And all of this really say or highlight that virtual teams are the future. So even before this coronavirus pandemic hit us, the trend was already moving towards that future. And if you think about the productivity savings, the employee satisfaction, and even the environmental benefits, right, the carbon footprint reduction, it was a win-win already. So it was a natural progression to move that towards virtual teams and virtual work. But now it's inevitable. And the takeaway here is that investing your time in learning about how to work better in a remote environment will pay off in the future. All right, so let's talk about the number one reason why virtual teams fail. So I've worked with a lot of managers and teams, and based on my own experience and research, I can boil down the number one reason why virtual teams fail to two words. And those two words are ineffective communication. So what is ineffective communication? Ineffective communication is the false assumption that what is being communicated to your remote team is being 100% understood by them, when in fact it's mostly misunderstood or misconstrued. And ineffective communication is the absolute core reason why a team as a whole ends up not executing according to a plan or being proactively engaged in getting some work done. And this leads to a huge waste of time for everyone. It leads to confusion among the team, long and useless meetings, endless back and forth emails, and ultimately team members that are not accountable or responsible. So communication is very, very important. And here's a little chart that kind of shows the how the degree of team virtuality affects the importance of communication, and it sort of increases logarithmically, if you will. And the idea here is that the greater the degree of team virtuality in teams, the higher the importance of communication. So as your team grows in size, whether it's in geography or even in cultural differences, the more important it is to focus on communicating properly. And that brings us to the number one best practice, and that is to avoid the curse of knowledge. Now, I usually give a lot of webinars and speeches about this topic. And if there's one thing you learn from this entire talk today, I hope that it's going to be this. And that's because the curse of knowledge is the root cause of evil in all communication, and it's a very challenging problem to avoid. So what is the curse of knowledge? Here's a definition. When we communicate with someone, we falsely assume that they have the same knowledge that we have in our own minds. And I know this might be a little bit of a confusing statement, so let me tell you about a little study called the Tappers and Listener Study that helps explain it. So the Tappers and Listener Study was a simple game that was conducted by Stanford University, I think back in the early 90s. And what happened was people were separated into two groups. Group A were the tappers, and Group B were the listeners. And what happened was that each tapper had to pick a song and tap out the rhythm to a listener by knocking on a table that was between them. And then the listener was then supposed to guess the song by listening to the taps. The tappers were first asked to, were basically sort of asked to predict the odds that the listeners would guess correctly, right? And by the way, the songs were things like lullabies, Happy Birthday to You, and you know, the simple songs. That was the list that was given to the tappers. And the tappers were basically asked to predict the odds that the listeners would guess correctly. And they assumed 50%. So the tappers assumed that one out of two people would guess this correctly. However, the actual number that the listeners got right was only 2.5%. So one in 40 got it right. And this was very shocking to the tappers. And some, you know, typical responses by the tappers were, isn't the song obvious? And how can you be so stupid, right? And this happened because when the tappers were tapping, they were hearing the songs in their own heads. And it was extremely hard for tappers to imagine what it's like to lack that knowledge. So this is the curse of knowledge. It's the fact that the knowledge that the tappers had in their head of those songs actually cursed them. And the curse of knowledge is a powerful concept that occurs everywhere, every day, across every single culture. And it happens between, for those of you who have kids, it happens between parents and their children. It happens between CEOs and their employees. And of course, it happens a lot among remote team members. And so it's a tricky problem to avoid. So here are some tactics for avoiding the curse of knowledge and how to beat it. So the first is to acknowledge that this curse of knowledge exists. And it exists in every single form of communication you make within your remote team. So whether it's in an email or a phone conversation or a presentation or a meeting, it always exists in those different forms of communication. And so just acknowledging it could help you think through the message you're trying to communicate. The second is to put yourself in the other person's shoes. So think about someone's experience, their background, their culture, and how they might be viewing what you're communicating before you communicate it out. And then finally, simplify your message, right? Try to make it as concrete as possible before you communicate it out. So I always give this example that I work with a lot more smarter engineers, and they basically use language that I sometimes don't understand as a project manager. And so I simply ask them to explain something to me like I'm a 15-year-old, right? To kind of dumb it down for me so that I'm able to digest it and to use smaller words and avoid using jargon to kind of explain how things fit together. So that's a great takeaway, to simplify your message by trying to kind of explain it to a teenager. All right, the second best practice is to over-communicate. So remote teams tend to be very siloed in nature, where everyone's working on their own thing. And this transactional feature easily leads to isolationism, right? Where this whole out of sight, out of mind thinking sin. And the fact that we have a lack of body language and facial expressions further exacerbates this problem, right? And to become a more effective leader, as a remote leader, basically, you want to put the effort to over-communicate with your team in this remote environment. And one topic here that I like to discuss, it's something called the propinquity effect. And this was a theory developed by psychologists at MIT, which basically states that the more you interact with someone, the more you'll like them and become friends with them. And the idea here is that repeat exposure through over-communication among your team will eventually lead to an increase in liking, which in turn leads to a stronger trust relationship. And I would argue that the opposite is also true, right? That a lack of interaction or repeat exposure would lead to this distancing factor. And so that's why it's really important to over-communicate with your team. So how do you do that? Here are some tactics for over-communicating. The first is to stay in touch with your team members. So staying in touch with your team members at least once every day or maybe every other day, even if it's not absolutely essential, is a good idea, right? And you can have fun while doing that. So an easy way to do this is to connect with them using instant messaging software, or maybe give them a quick call every once in a while just to check on things. The second is to ensure that everyone's voice is heard. So you want to make sure that you're inclusive of your team's opinions and ask them to speak up whenever you're in a team setting, right? And keep in mind that in a remote team, people are usually less vocal due to the lack of body language. So even if someone is actively agreeing, they might not be explicitly saying it, right? Because people cannot pick up on the subtleties like facial expressions. And so it's a good idea to ask for what your team's thoughts are when you're in a virtual meeting. And then finally, send frequent FYI updates. So FYI stands for your information. And this is another way to over-communicate, where you send a quick update to your team members to let them know what they're doing. And the frequent part here is the most important portion of this formula that will help you stay up to date on what everyone is doing. All right, so that was the second best practice, to over-communicate. The third is to leverage the pyramid of communication. So let's kick this off by talking about the main challenge of virtual teams. Now, the main challenge of virtual teams is that they lack the common face-to-face interaction that is typically available in regular co-located teams, right? At the end of the day, this is really what differentiates virtual teams or remote teams. And by the way, I use virtual teams and remote teams synonymously. They mean the exact same thing. And that's what differentiates virtual teams from co-located teams. And to help explain this challenge, let's look at the team proximity spectrum. So think of a team's composition as being a point on the spectrum, right? A simple line with 100% virtual team on one end and 100% co-located on the other end. And the idea here is that if your current team is on point A of the spectrum, which is closer to 100% virtual team, then changing the composition of the team so that it's on point B, which is closer to 100% co-located, will actually reduce the challenges faced by the team and increase intimacy. So how do you accomplish that? How do you move from point A to point B? To understand how to do that and how to increase intimacy and cohesion, you should look at the pyramid of communication. And the pyramid of communication is basically a pyramid that shows the different technologies that are typically used to communicate within virtual teams. And the higher you are in the pyramid, the more intimate the form of communication and the better it is for the team's cohesive traits. So let me give you an example of one here. So here's a little pyramid that shows email at the bottom of the pyramid and then face-to-face communication at the top. And the idea is that the lower you are in the pyramid, the less intimate the form of communication. So it starts at the bottom with email. A step above that is instant messaging or social media. A little bit above that is the phone or teleconferencing using audio only. So that has a little bit better a better fidelity of communication, if you will. And then video conferencing is a step above audio conferencing or teleconferencing. And that's better because it shows a little bit of the facial expressions. And then telepresence, which I call video conferencing on steroids. If you've never heard of the technology, it's basically life-size video conferencing. So you kind of sit in a room and it shows your different peers or colleagues or team members in different countries, but in using life-size screens, which is amazing. And that's better than video conferencing because you can pick up on the micro subtleties of body language as well. And then the highest form of communication is, of course, face-to-face communication. So what do you do with this? What's the idea behind the pyramid of communication and how we can use it to improve intimacy? There are two things you should do. The first is to move up the pyramid. And the second is to mix multiple levels of the pyramid, right? So let me give you an example of that. So moving up the pyramid, let's say you spend most of your time in email, right? You communicate with your team most of the time through email. Then what you want to do basically is try to take it up a couple notches. So try to pick up the phone and call someone. Let's say you've got a team member based in India and you're always used to communicating with them through email. You know, picking up the phone and calling them is a great idea. Or having an audio conference just to, again, get that extra level of fidelity of communication. Or even moving it up a notch to video conferencing, right? So if you do have a staff call with your team and you're used to always being communicating either on email or maybe audio conferencing, then asking everyone to turn on video is a fantastic idea because then you get the facial expressions as well. Another way to improve intimacy is to mix multiple levels of the pyramid. So for example, if you spend most of your time on audio conferencing, then you want to mix it up a little bit by trying to incorporate face-to-face communication. Now, of course, during the pandemic, this is, you know, to basically focus on social distancing, that's not a good idea. But in regular times, and hopefully when this is completely over, and you have the budget for it, having a face-to-face meeting, such as an offsite, is a great idea to build the team. But even if not, you also want to mix different levels. So mixing social media maybe within your within your team setting or instant messaging is a great idea as well to improve intimacy and cohesion. All right, so what are some tactics for leveraging the pyramid of communication? The first is that you want to observe how you currently communicate with your remote team and where you spend most of your time in that pyramid. And the two things, again, are to move up the pyramid to increase intimacy and cohesion, and the higher is the better, and then mix multiple levels of the pyramid, and more is better as well. All right, the fourth best practice is to write assertive emails. Now, this is a topic that could be covered in an entire course and book, but I do want to point out a couple of high-level best practices here for you that will help you out. So we've got a couple of problems with email. The first is that email is the second largest time waster for remote employees. Meetings is the first. And according to now outdated McKinsey study, email takes around 11 hours a week of your time. I think it's definitely more today. But I think that's because of two sub-reasons. One is a quantity problem. So we get a lot of emails. And the other is a quality problem, meaning we get a lot of bad emails, right? You know, that's probably why we have email as the second largest time waster. Another is that people don't read long emails anymore. And there's this snazzy response with TLDR, which stands for too long didn't read. And people just scan emails, right? They just don't have the time to read like 300 emails every day, you know, line by line. And so writing straight to the point emails is a win-win for you and your readers. So what are some tactics for writing assertive emails? The first is common sense, right? Keep your emails as short and concise as possible. And the sweet spot is to keep them at 5 sentences or less. And there's even a whole website dedicated to that. If you go to 5.sentence with just a C and then .es, it kind of gives a nice little page there for you. And you should also try to get to your point, to the point of your email, I should say, I'm sorry, early on in your message, right? So preferably in the first sentence or two, so that you don't waste your recipient's time with any fluff. And according to research by Carnegie Mellon University, emails that are easy to address get answered faster, right? So they did the study where if you send 100 emails and maybe the 99th email that you send is the easiest to address, that's probably what is going to be answered first, right? You're going to get a faster response. So try to make your emails, again, short and concise, and you'll gain the advantage that they're going to be addressed quickly. And the second is to highlight your calls to action. And calls to action are the action items or tasks that you want your email recipients to accomplish. And so because people scan emails, you should avoid burying your calls to action in multiple paragraphs. A lot of times what happens is that I see 8-paragraph long emails with an action request in like sentence 3 of paragraph 5, and that never works, right? People are just not going to see it. So a best practice is to highlight those calls to action so that they are easily identifiable within an email. And my default method is to basically list out each call to action in a separate bullet point, but you can also use bolding or italics or maybe underlining or even different colored fonts to draw attention to those action items. So the idea here is just to make them stand out and not buried in your email. All right, so that was the fourth best practice. The fifth best practice is to use deadlines strategically. And this is about how to assign tasks using deadlines. And first, let's talk about the important concept or an important concept to understand why deadlines are important. And that is Parkinson's Law. And Parkinson's Law states that work expands so as to fill the time available for its completion. And, you know, a lot of this is sort of this premise that we are all, as human beings, naturally lazy. And there are plenty of psychological reasons for procrastinating. But Parkinson's Law is one of them. And said another way, if a task would take 1 hour to complete, then if you assign a 3-hour deadline to it, it will take up the full 3 hours to get done, right? And the flip side of that is that if a task does not have a deadline associated with it, it will never get done, right? And by the way, Parkinson's Law applies to both self-imposed tasks, those that you give yourself, as well as delegated tasks, those that you assign to someone. And so it's really, really important to set deadlines. And some ideas behind why deadlines are important, in addition to avoiding Parkinson's Law, is that they develop a sense of urgency and they help people avoid procrastination. They hold people accountable, your team members accountable. They do also provide a sense of encouragement, right? Because those tasks that have a deadline associated with them have a higher chance of actually being done. And then they also provide a sense of accomplishment. So after you meet the deadline, you always get that sense that you accomplished something. So they're definitely a win-win, and it's important to set deadlines. So how do you set deadlines strategically? Here are a few tactics that will help you out. The first is to be reasonable. So you want to be reasonable about the time you set for a deadline for a particularly a remote team member. And if you know that a task needs a week to complete, then don't ask for it to be done in 2 days, right? I know a lot of managers kind of use that strategy because they think they're going to get something faster, but unfortunately it backfires with a lack of quality, right? And if you don't know how long a task needs to get something to get done, I should say, then ask for feedback, right? Ask your team for feedback. A good strategy basically is to ask for like an optimistic timeline, a pessimistic timeline, and a most likely timeline, and then sort of average them out, right? So someone could say, yeah, best case, I'd get this to you in a week. Worst case, it's 3 weeks, you know, most likely a couple of weeks, right? So you can kind of estimate it there as a deadline. The second tactic for using deadlines strategically is to be clear cut. And you want to be 100% clear cut about when the deadline actually is, right? So you want to mention the day, the dates, and the time that you need a task completed by, because deadlines are ineffective if they're ambiguous, I should say. So let me give you an example. An example of an ambiguous deadline is, I need this done in the next few days, right? A better example of that would be, I need this done by Thursday, June 16th at 5 p.m. Eastern time, right? In the ambiguous example where you need this done in the next few days, someone could basically translate a few days as 2 days, and others could be 17, right? So you want to be very clear about the day, the date, and the time. And then finally, you always, always, always want to use deadlines. Otherwise, Parkinson's Law takes over. And even if you don't really have a deadline, then using a fake deadline is okay, right? No one's really going to know. And then you might ask, well, if a deadline is a few weeks out, what do you do? my suggestion is to use an intermediate soft deadline as a checkpoint, right? To kind of say, all right, the deadline really for this is in 6 weeks, but how about we meet in 3 weeks to kind of check in on progress and see where we are with the task. All right, so that was the fifth best practice. The sixth best practice is to assign responsibility the right way. And this is a best practice about how to properly assign tasks. And to talk about that, let's look at what happened back in the 1960s with an interesting murder case. So this is a picture of Kitty Genovese. And Kitty Genovese was a young woman who was stabbed to death in New York City back in 1964. And what happened was that over the course of half an hour, she was attacked 3 times on the street as neighbors watched from their windows. And there were 38 witnesses to this horrific event, yet not a single person called the police during the attack. And what happened back in the day is that this caused a huge outcry in the community, and it prompted a couple of psychologists, well-known psychologists actually, Bibb Latain and John Darley, to conduct a series of studies to understand why this happened. And they came up with a name for it, and that name is the bystander effect. And the bystander effect refers to the idea that the greater the number of bystanders in an emergency, the less likely it is that any one of them will help. And it is closely related to the diffusion of responsibility concept. So, you know, this idea where people are less likely to take responsibility when others are present. If you've ever heard the phrase, everyone's responsibility is no one's responsibility, this is kind of where it comes from. And the takeaway here is that if Kitty Genovese didn't have so many witnesses, then the chances of someone calling for help would have actually increased. And so the lesson here for virtual teams is that if people are not willing to take action to help someone who is dying due to the bystander effect, then they will probably not take responsibility for assigned tasks in groups, right? And in remote teams or virtual teams, this bystander effect is compounded even further because of the lack of face-to-face interaction, right? So this is why you need to assign responsibility the right way. So how do you do that? Here are some tactics for assigning responsibility. The first is to use direct language. Now, direct language is basically straight to the point language that tells people exactly who is responsible for getting something done. And you want to use direct language whenever you can or whenever you assign responsibility to avoid confusion and ambiguity. So let me give you a couple of examples. So an example of indirect language, or a bad example, is Jesse, I think we should work on this task. A better example of that, or a more direct example of that, is Jesse, I need you to work on this task. So notice it's a slight difference in language, but the first is more about, hey, I think we should work on this task, whereas the second is, I need you to work on this task, right? Because in the first, it might be like, well, are you in brainstorming mode? Are you kind of still considering it? Are you still thinking about it? But because some managers are more on the nice side, right? They don't want to, they kind of want to sugarcoat the ask and try to kind of ask nicely. It ends up being a little bit more on the confusing side. A second best practice is to ask for volunteers. So asking for volunteers to take on a task has a couple of advantages. First, it increases the chances of the task actually being done because of something called the internal consistency concept. So people are more likely to follow through on getting something done if they signed up voluntarily for it. And then second, it gives people a chance to work on what they want to work on, right? So you're going to get happier team members and a higher level of motivation. But even if the situation does not allow for volunteers, or no one actually volunteers, then you should still assign responsibility to a person anyway. Otherwise, the bystander effect is going to kick in. And then finally, you want to assign to individuals and not to groups, right? You always want to assign a task to a single person, because otherwise, if you assign it to a group, then you will still create the bystander effect within that small group. And if a task requires more than one person to work on it, then what you want to do is assign the primary responsibility to one person and then the secondary responsibility to others. So let me give you a couple of examples. A bad example would be John, Mary, and Sam will be responsible for completing this task. A better example would be John will be responsible for completing this task, and both Mary and Sam will help him out, right? Again, subtle difference in the way in which you assign the task, but in the better example, you're assigning the task to a single primary leader and then a couple of other team members that are backing him or her up. And that always works better than saying, you three people are going to work on this, right? So assign a leader. All right, so that covers the six best practices that we just discussed. Here's a quick summary of what we covered today. The number one reason for failure is ineffective communication. So that's really, really important. Avoid the curse of knowledge by putting yourself in someone else's shoes. That's the first best practice we covered. The second best practice was to over-communicate with your team by staying in touch with them maybe once every day or every couple of days just to make sure you're connected. Leverage the pyramid of communication by moving up the pyramid and mixing multiple levels of the technology that you're using. Write assertive emails by being very direct and highlighting your calls to action. Use deadlines strategically by specifying an exact date and time and always using them. And then finally, assign responsibility the right way by using direct language, asking volunteers, and assigning to individuals and not to groups. Thanks so much for watching. I hope you found this valuable. If you'd like to connect, you can connect with me on the couchmanager.com, which is my blog, and I've got all my social media accounts there for us to stay in touch or if you have any questions. Thank you.
Friends, if you like this episode of the LeadX Leadership Podcast, please take a minute, leave a rating on iTunes or Stitcher. Ratings are invaluable for attracting new listeners. And I like to convert those listeners into leaders because, you know, I'm on a mission to spark 100 million leaders in the next 10 years. And if you want to become the boss everyone fights to work for and nobody wants to leave, check out the LeadX platform with Coach Amanda at leadx.org. And if you have 10 or more managers who could use some binge-worthy training, send me an email at info@leadx.org, leadx.org. And we'll talk about getting you set up with a totally free pilot for those managers. See if they like it. If they don't, that's fine. We go away. Part as friends. But if they love it, you've just found yourself a new resource for them. Remember, leadership is influence. You're always leading. How are you going to lead today?